Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Susan Fisher. I'm from Fairfield and Woods. My attorney number is 33174. I'm here representing Jenny Schneider and Joan Hergenrader. Excuse me. I'm here representing the defendants, counterclaimants, and appellants. There are several issues that we have raised upon appeal, and what it seems to really come down to is when the causes of actions for the counterclaims that my clients brought at trial actually accrued. As you know from reviewing the briefs, we raised claims for breach of fiduciary duty, breach of trust, conversion, and also asked for an accounting. To end a joint tenancy, there must be a show of intent to do so, that there's no right of survivorship, because the thing that is distinctive, as you know, about a joint tenancy is that right of survivorship. When one of the tenants perishes, then the others have the right to take the property that's held in tenancy. Here, in this instance, none of the tenants showed an intent to end or convey his interest in the tenancy to a third party. What did happen was that some of the money from the investment pool was placed in bank accounts rather than being reinvested in the investments that the joint tenants had agreed would happen. This didn't change the ownership of the property. When Mother, Mrs. Hergenrader, passed away, the joint tenancy was intact. And regardless of where the money was being kept,
Excuse me, Ms. Fisher, you started out your argument with one question. You said the critical issue here is when did the counterclaims accrue? Is that fair? Is that a fair statement of what you said?
Yes, Your Honor.
When did they accrue?
They accrued at
Ms. Waitman or Wallman said they all accrued back in 2001 and 1999, 2001 and so forth. In the prior litigation, do you agree or disagree?
We disagree.
Well, isn't that the fundamental question? Forget the joint tenancy for the moment, but isn't that the fundamental question? That's where the trial judge made his order regarding the statute of limitations.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, go ahead from there.
Our position is that that our counterclaims accrued upon the death of Mother in August of 2005. And as such, the court erred in deciding that all of our counterclaims were barred by the statute of limitations.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Are you arguing that because of the nature of the joint tenancy, that the statute of limitations then runs differently than it ordinarily would upon the discovery of the nature of the claim?
I'm not sure that it runs differently, Your Honor. I think that because of the nature of joint tenancies, the actual right to the property arises when that person dies. And at that point, there would be knowledge of the claims that would be raised. For instance, conversion. Prior to the date that the mother died, the defendants could not have known that their sister was converting the funds, that she was not going to go ahead and do as they had all agreed, that all of the funds would be distributed among the joint tenants.
And you're saying this even though there was earlier litigation?
I am saying that even though there was earlier litigation.
And didn't the trial court, though, make a finding of fact that there was knowledge about some of these activities back in the 1990s and up to 2001? And given that finding, aren't we, unless there's no record support for it, aren't we bound by that as an appellate court?
I think that I think that we can distinguish between what they discovered in the 90s and what actually happened when the rights accrued. My understanding is the court found that that the defendants didn't have any basis for their claim because they knew about the fact that sister was taking money and putting it into bank accounts. Well, just the fact that she was taking it in and putting it into bank accounts did not give definite knowledge that money was not going to end up being distributed among the joint tenants upon the vesting event, which was the death of the mother.
Wouldn't your clients have had a pretty good idea of that, though, if those bank accounts didn't list them as joint owners?
Well, they had a suspicion, certainly. However, Genevieve Schneider testified that mother assured her over and over again that the money was being reinvested, that it was all still in this joint tenancy. And so she was allaying her fears all along, saying, you know, even if you're concerned about this, don't be concerned because it's being taken care of. We're filling out the certificates and we're reinvesting this money. And the money that was going into the bank accounts, because of these reassurances, I expect that our clients were saying, okay, this is still in the joint tenancy.
Well, Ms. Fisher, as you can tell from my first question, I think that's the heart of the case right now. The way it's structured at the present time is, when did these counterclaims, when did your clients have knowledge or should have known about what was going on? And the trial judge concluded that was back in 1999 and 2001 and so on. And as Judge Lowe said, if there's any evidence to support that, then we're looking here on the standard of abuse of discretion. Why shouldn't we accept the trial judge's findings?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm not sure that I heard your entire question. Would you mind repeating it?
Surely, I'd be glad to.
Thank you.
The heart of this case is not about the joint tenancy account, in my view. It's, when did the knowledge of your clients, did they know of what was going on, and or when they should have known it was going on? The trial judge found that, based upon all the evidence that he had, including the 2001 deposition, I think it was with Ms. Wakeman, was that they knew or should have known in 1999 or 2000. Now, if there's any evidence to support that conclusion, where do we go? Where does this panel go from there?
Well,
because the standard of review is abuse of discretion, wouldn't you agree?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Okay.
The statute of limitations for the counterclaims that my clients brought are triggered by, as you said, knowledge or should have known, a level of knowledge or should
right.
have known. And with a breach of fiduciary duty, the statute of limitation begins to run.
They shouldn't knew or should have known. And the trial judge found that they knew or should have known back in 1999 or 2001. Now, what are we supposed to do with that finding? If there's any evidence to support it, or no evidence, which is your position, that there's no evidence to support that finding?
Our position is that his finding is incorrect.
Why is it incorrect? Because there's no evidence to support it?
What I'm hearing you say is that he found that even based on the 2001 deposition, that there's no evidence, but we disagree. We think that the 2001 deposition of Ms. Waldman, in which she said that she had already gotten money and that there would be money for everybody and that there was money in bank accounts that would be included in this joint tenancy that would be distributed when the vesting event occurred. I understand that it is a finding and that is problematic. However, we think that the court did err in this case in determining that the statute of limitations had run.
because the court should have accepted the 2001 deposition testimony instead of the other evidence that it relied on?
I don't know what the court took into account.
Right. Well, I'm just trying to understand the, if you have evidence that's in the 2001 deposition that would support your point of view, and you have evidence of the prior litigation and what the party should have known and et cetera that supports the trial court's finding, then you can't say that there's no evidence. There's just two different funds of evidence.
That's right. And they are inconsistent. Ms. Waldman's testimony was inconsistent from the first deposition to the trial. There's some inconsistency there, and I of course am stating that her first statements were the truth in her deposition. That deposition was used as rebuttal, and so I think that the court should take that into account and weigh whether which one he thinks is more truthful.
But isn't that what the trial court did? And we can't do that as an appellate court, can we? I mean, we can't judge credibility.
No, Your Honor. You are here to determine the law, and that is why I'm most concerned about when the counterclaims accrued, so that when the statute of limitations would run, so that this case could be remanded for retrial.
But I guess the problem that we're all having up here is the law appears to be in Colorado that when a statute accrues is a question of fact. And here we have a finding of fact. And so as an appellate court, I think all three of us are struggling. And so what do we do with that?
And I follow up on Judge Lowe's statement. I think that the Colorado Supreme Court, in fact, I'm sure of it, in 1984, came down with the Mastro versus Brody opinion, and it simply stated in one sentence, determining the point at which a statute of limitations begins to run is generally a question of fact.
And it can be considered a question of law if we know when the events began, when the wrongdoing began. And the reason that I began my argument this afternoon with the way that joint tenancies work is that when a joint tenancy accrues at the death of that person, and all the rights of the parties begin at that point in time. And so that's when we believe, and we think the law supports that that's when the statute of limitations begins. We think that's a definite time, and so then we do think that this court can determine as a matter of law when a claim accrued under the statute of limitations.
Does that get back to my first question? Is there something special about the joint tenancy that would cause the statute of limitations to run differently?
I believe that all of the counterclaims arise from this joint tenancy and the agreement that the joint tenants had, and the rights that the joint tenants have are vested at the moment of death of mother. And so, yes, I think that it is, it is.
Well, as an example, the breach of fiduciary duty, is that run from the joint tenancy? Is there a fiduciary duty of one joint tenant to another? That's number one. Number two, there was another one, breach of trust, which the trial court concluding was a constructive trust, I believe. And thirdly, from the standpoint of the accounting, the court in effect said all that's moot because the money has been in the registry of the court for years and years and years. Now, to follow up on Judge Morris's question, I'll let you go from there.
Okay. You asked if the breach of fiduciary duty, when that accrues, and it begins to run when the injury or loss or the damage or conduct giving rise to the cause of action is discovered. And I am arguing that it was discovered when the rights in the joint tenancy accrued at mother's death.
Is there one joint tenancy here, or is there joint tenancies for all the different investments?
There's
separately.
There's one joint tenancy for the investments. the funds that went into the separate bank accounts came from that joint tenancy.
Thank you, counsel. Your time's up.
Good afternoon, if it pleases the court. My name is Steve Harris. My registration number is 11314. I represent Barbara Waldman, the plaintiff, one of the plaintiffs in the case, and also the appellee in this matter. I'm not going to go into great detail about what happened, but I want to talk about procedure a bit. Barbara Waldman and Christine Hergenreiter, the mother who died in August of 2005.
Before you start that, let's follow up on the argument that Ms. Fisher just has made and these issues which the three judges of this panel seem to be concerned with.
I believe the trial court did make a factual finding.
Okay. When does this cause of action accrue, if you will?
Okay.
Regarding the statute of limitations.
Let me address one issue regarding the joint tenancy. I think there were many joint tenancies established. I think each one of these certificates established by virtue of their issuance in joint names a joint tenancy. Then what happened in 1992 when the father died, Christine Hergenreiter's husband died, there were some investments placed, there were several investments placed in joint names of the three children and the mother. And somewhere in 95, 96, those got reinvested. Some of them did not get reinvested. And the act or the event that occurred was that Christine Hergenreiter did not put those certificates back in the four names that they came out of. And so the complaint that we've seen by these defendants and the counterclaims is that they believe that what Christine Hergenreiter did was wrong. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to place that on Barbara Waldman as being one of the joint tenants, saying that she had the obligation to carry out her mother's stated intentions 15 years later, and that is to somehow distribute money upon her death to these children. And that's not what happened factually. What happened was there were events where money got placed into different investments, got held differently, got put into bank accounts. And in 1999, this event was discovered. And there was a lawsuit filed, and in 2000, there was subpoenas issued and documents were produced. And in 2001, my client, the plaintiff in this case, was deposed about those investments. And she was asked a series of questions about what her mother had decided she wanted to do or not do. At the time, Christine Hergenreiter was alive. She was the one in control of these funds. She was the one making the decisions on all of these investments and how they were going to go. So when Barbara was asked, what do you think it's going to happen? Well, she said, mother said, well, we're each going to get $100,000 and there may be $60,000 that go to the grandchildren. She was just parroting what her mother had told her might be the outcome later on upon death. So that's when the events occurred and the cause of actions accrue when you know about conduct. And the conduct is that if your joint tenancy property, which you've entrusted in somebody, I think in this case, Christine Hergenreiter, has not resulted in a like investment down the road where you're named again as a joint tenant, then you have a complaint. And you may not know the actual damages have accrued, but you know all of the facts that have led to a possible malfeasance. And it is that moment in time that the actual cause of action accrues, unless the injured parties don't know about that act, in which case it's when they discover it. So in this case, we have 1995, 96, and 97 transactions, which were discovered in 99 and 2000. So I would contend that probably in 2000, when the evidence was discovered, was when the actions accrued. But at the very latest, when Barbara Waldman discussed all of these transactions that happened in 95, 96, 97, when she said this is what happened to the money, that's when the causes of actions accrued, and that's when the claims could have been brought and were in fact brought in the prior litigation, which is why the judge in this case decided that prior litigation had really fleshed out all of the issues, and the fact that we were trying that same case again many, many years later was inappropriate under statute of limitations, and that's why he found they were all barred.
Can I skip ahead to another issue?
Sure.
If I can, please. Let's assume that the trial court was right on the statute of limitations. The court went on and awarded attorney's fees under 1317-201. This was frivolous, vexatious. What is it about this case that distinguishes it from any other case where the court holds that the statute of limitations has accrued and the claims were filed in time. Why is this
more egregious?
More egregious, quite frankly, than any other statute of limitations case.
Well, there's the rule is that there must be substantial justification for the claims made, and if there's not substantial justification, then the court may award attorney's fees under the statute. In this case, there wasn't a substantially justified argument made about the statute of limitations.
Just because they lost?
No, not just because they lost, because they had already filed a lawsuit and dealt with all these same issues in 2001. So how is it the court was sitting here and was sitting there looking at saying, well, how is it that I'm having to deal with the statute of limitations when you ought to know every bit of facts here before you should indicate that you should never bring this case because it's time barred. So the point is that it's either you form a rule as an appellate court that says that if we have a statute of limitations case, then you can never have a groundless and frivolous case, or you look at the facts and the situation that arises, the egregious nature of the fact that they brought a lawsuit in 2007 on claims that they essentially brought in 2000, in 1999, was what led the court to come to the conclusion that it said, look, you guys knew that you were going to get knocked out of this case on the statute of limitations. You knew that was going to happen, and you've wasted my time for a day and a half, and you can't come up with any argument and any offer of proof that would tell me that I should look at something and consider something seriously. So that was one reason. The other reason is that if you...
my recollection, but didn't the state legislature decide frivolous and groundless litigation was warranted with the support for attorney's fees?
I'm sorry, you hear the last of it.
Excuse me. Refresh my recollection. Wasn't it at one time that the legislature decided that frivolous groundless litigation warranted or would give the judge the authority to award attorney's fees?
I think that's what the statute provided. It was to give you in 1317.201, I believe it is, says that at some point in time, if the court finds that the cause of action of maintenance or the defense of a claim is substantially frivolous or lacks substantial justification, could then decide whether or not appropriate to award attorney fees. One thing that we haven't talked about today at all is that there were if you look at the record, and I would direct you to the second day, page 42, this is after Genevieve Snyder has had an opportunity. This is one of the defendants and counterclaimants has had an opportunity to give her testimony on the second day. And I object, and I say, look, I've been listening to this for a long time, but I want to oppose objection now to the fact that we're not getting to the issues that they want to get to. And from that point, for about 15, 20, 25 pages, the court discusses with me and with Mr. Pels, who was the attorney who tried the case, about what were they going to do, what could they bring, and what type of evidence were they going to be able to talk about. And what it distilled down to, if you look at Mr. Pels' comments, he's saying that really what it's all about is that there's a $60,000 that was supposed to go to the grandkids. And we believe that $60,000 ought to go to the grandkids and that my clients ought to be able to take that out of Ms. Wallman's one-third, which was not in dispute. Everybody had a one-third, but it was a question of should they be able to invade her one-third to pay for these grandchildren's inheritance, if you will. And the judge also found very specifically is that these two counterclaimants lacked standing in that court to bring a claim on behalf of the grandchildren who were all by that time adults. So there's another reason here is that if the nub of your entire argument, your entire claim, if it all distills down to the $60,000 that did not get to the kids, then how can you step into this court as well and make a claim when you know you're not those children, that they have to intervene, they need to be the party standing before me asking for that remedy? And that, I think, added to the egregious nature of the case. And it wasn't decided just on the statute of limitations, although the court let out with that, said, you know, all the claims are barred by that. But he also said as to that money, which was all that was really being sought, when it was all distilled down to the final analysis, said also, the wrong parties before me, and I cannot award that.
So the court actually made findings on that issue?
Yes, made findings on that as well. Said that there's no real party in interest before me. those two things, those two components, as well as the argument about the 1380-109, which is the offset of stale claims, the judge again said, there's no evidence to support that. You haven't provided me with anything to support the fact that these are common issues of fact, that they're that they were pled within 1 year of the statute of limitations, I mean, of the complaint being filed. So these arguments, none of them actually held any water when the final analysis. It wasn't a hard call for the judge to stop the case, because when it became apparent that there wasn't going to be anything more, that my client was the thrust of their case by calling my client as an adverse witness the first day, and they tried to elicit pretty much out of her verbatim out of her deposition. They could have put her deposition in evidence and avoided the court having to sit through the whole trial of that particular aspect. But if you look at it, all those deposition testimonies just recounted. They're asking the witness, did you say this? Yes, I did say that. That's where the judge, okay, listened to that part of the case, and then they called Genevieve Snyder, who was one of the counterclaims, and then she had nothing to add to it, really, other than she wanted to talk about some issues and feeling like mother didn't do these things. And if you look at her testimony, which is about 40 pages in length, it really boils down to the fact that she was really upset with her mother. And her mother's not a party to this case. Her mother was a party to this case. Her mother died. Her estate was a party to this case. And her estate was then dismissed out by the counterclaimants. So the correct party on that issue might have been before the court. It wasn't even there as well. The trial court didn't really talk a whole lot about that, but that was, in fact, what was the biggest complaint was, is that mother said she was going to do this. You told us in your deposition in 2001 that mother was going to do these things, and it didn't happen. And you got all this money back in 1995 from mother, and you should have paid that over to us or paid it to the grandchildren at the very least. And that was the thrust of their case. Based upon the totality of that, the trial court felt that the entire case was groundless and frivolous. And sua sponte just said, and by the way, I'm finding that this is in fact the case. I didn't really make any arguments other than I might have initially in my opening statement made a comment to the fact it was groundless and frivolous. So I didn't have to make a separate motion at the end of the trial.
Am I correct in understanding that or is there a dispute as to the reasonableness of the fee which the trial judge imposed upon?
No, there was no response filed as to the reasonableness of the fee.
Thank you.
We've asked for attorney's fees on appeal as well, and we're asking that if based upon the fact that this was a decision of fact that the trial court could make and did make, and that this court is really powerless to overrule unless there's abuse of discretion or if there's a lack of evidence of the record to support the finding that there was an accrual of the cause of actions in 2001 at the latest. Therefore, this appeal in and of itself would be groundless and frivolous. And that's been an argument that we raised in our briefs. And if you have any other questions, otherwise I have nothing further to add. I do one other thing I would like to say. I do want to address the death of Christine Hergevater. There is this sense that that is a triggering event, that something that causes a distribution right. And I would submit that under joint tenancy law, when one of the joint tenants of multiple joint tenancies dies, that interest is extinguished, but the remaining parties remain in joint tenants. It doesn't create an event where you go out and distribute the money. It's being treated as if the death of mother in 2005 was actually a testamentary event wherein there should have been a distribution that occurred afterwards. And this is not a testamentary device. This is a joint tenancy that occurred. The stock certificates, which are on the proceeds of which are on deposit with the registry of the court, are the same ones that my client brought in 2004 saying, please endorse the checks before we lose the right to this money. That's the money is in the court. Those are the only certificates that were held in joint tenancy by name. And this concept of a joint pool is really almost akin to some notion that there was a joint venture going on from back in 1992 and that these parties were part of a joint venture, and therefore the joint venture allows this distribution of money in 2005, even though the money's nature has been converted several times into other investments and ultimately into bank accounts, which are no longer naming any of the original joint tenants complaining as parties.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. Case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course. That completes our docket for the 1:30 cases. I think what the court's going to do now is take a very brief, 5 minutes at the most, recess, let counsel for the 2:30 case set up, and then we'll come back and hear that case. So the bailiff may announce a recess.